Chapter 73. Unwanted Lovers. The crime writer experiences something very like nostalgia when he looks back on some of the classic cases of unwanted lovers. They seem curiously innocent and straightforward compared to the more recent examples. Madeline Smith, Patrick Mahon, Norman Thorne all found themselves involved in tiresome entanglements and brooded on the simple way out. Nowadays, the cases of unwanted lovers are usually complicated by perversion, promiscuity, or by sheer viciousness. The Wigwam murder is perhaps the last of the classic cases. It also occupies a distinguished place in the annals of medical detection. On October the 7th, 1942, two Marines walking over Hankley Common in Surrey observed an arm sticking out of a mound of earth. They hurried back to camp to report it. The next day, a group of police officers, accompanied by the noted pathologist Professor Keith Simpson, went to the site with shovels and proceeded to unearth the body. It was that of a girl, fully dressed and badly decomposed. It was clear that she had been killed by heavy blows on the head, and since the police had no clue to the girl's identity, Simpson asked for the body to be sent back to his laboratory at Guy's Hospital in London. There it was immersed in a bath of disinfectant, and during the next week, Simpson and his secretary spent their tea breaks seated beside the bath, while the famous pathologist dictated notes on the nature of the injuries. This painstaking work paid off. Simpson was able to tell Inspector Fred Greenough of Scotland Yard just how the girl had met her death. Her assailant had started to stab her in the top of the head, using a knife with a peculiar hooked tip. She had first tried to ward off the blows, receiving injuries to her right arm and hand, and then had run away, before tripping and falling so violently that she knocked out several front teeth. Her killer stood over her and dealt her a tremendous blow with a blunt instrument that killed her instantly, also causing her cheek to strike the ground so violently that it was fractured. The man had then dragged her uphill on her right side, there were scratch marks on the top of the right leg, and buried her. It was odd that he had chosen the top of a hill. Armed with this information, and a rough physical description of the girl and her clothing, Greenough approached the local police. They said that it sounded like a description of Joan Pearl Wolfe, regarded as an amateur prostitute. She had apparently run away from home sometime in 1941 and had been living rough in the area of the army camp. She had vanished about 3 weeks before. Oddly enough, she was also a Roman Catholic with strong religious convictions. She was known as the Wigwam Girl. The police made a very long and very detailed search of Hankley Common, and one by one they found the clues that they needed. Joan Wolfe's identity card, a religious tract, her shoes, and a letter to a Canadian private called Auguste Sangré, telling him that she was pregnant. Greenough called on Sangré at the nearby army camp. The soldier turned out to be half Native American. He readily admitted knowing Joan Pearl Wolfe, in fact, to sleeping rough with her in a kind of wigwam construction on the common. And with his own background, he found nothing odd in a girl living in the middle of a common. He claimed that he had not seen her for several weeks, and also, significantly, that his clasp knife had been stolen from near the wigwam a short time before she disappeared. The net closed around him. No one else had a motive for killing Joan Wolfe, but it was established that Sangré had obtained a marriage application from his commanding officer, and this was found near the site of the wigwam. What finally established his guilt was the discovery of a battle dress and blanket, both bloodstained, although an attempt had been made to wash them. The battle dress was identified as Sangré's, and the bloodstains and hairs were also found on a heavy birch stake near the murder scene. All the police needed now was the knife with which she had been stabbed. This was discovered in the army camp by a maintenance man who was investigating a blockage in a waste pipe leading from a wash basin. It proved to be a clasp knife with a hooked point. And then someone recalled that while Sangré was waiting to be interviewed by Greenough, he had asked if he could go to the wash house. In court, Sangré showed true passivity as he listened to the evidence that would cost him his life. It became clear that this was no accidental murder during the course of a quarrel. The initial stab wounds were in the top of the head, so she must have been sitting or stooping. She had run away, but fell over an army tripwire and smashed her teeth. Sangré stood over her and dispatched her with one blow. Simpson produced the skull in court, wired together like a jigsaw puzzle, to demonstrate the savagery of that blow. And then Sangré had wrapped the upper part of the body in a blanket to avoid leaving a trail of blood, and dragged her to a hilltop to bury her, as his ancestors had always buried their enemies. In spite of a recommendation for mercy, Sangaré was hanged at Wandsworth Prison on April the 29th, 1943. In certain basic respects, the wigwam murder is typical of its kind. Sangaré was willing to sleep with the bedraggled wigwam girl, with her reputation for promiscuity, but not to marry her. Most men have a strong and automatic preference for virtue. They may enjoy sleeping with promiscuous girls, but they prefer to marry virgins. Our permissive society has seen the gradual erosion of this idea, but in the Victorian age no one questioned it. The very fact that a girl had yielded her virtue to a man was enough to make him feel a certain basic contempt for her, and society was inclined to agree with him. The Reverend Anthony Haydon was almost certainly the murderer of Mary Stannard, a 22-year-old maidservant whose body was found near Rockland, Connecticut, in 1878. Her skull had been fractured and her throat cut. Medical examination revealed arsenic in the stomach. Mary Stannard had once been a servant in the house of the Reverend Anthony Haydon, and had subsequently talked frankly about the clergyman's passionate nature. She had also mentioned that she believed herself to be pregnant, for the second time, and that the Reverend Haydon intended to give her some medicine to induce an abortion. Haydon was unable to account for his movements on the afternoon of her death, although his wife later insisted that he had spent the afternoon chopping wood. When it was discovered that he had purchased an ounce of arsenic, he was arrested, and there was widespread sympathy for him. After all, he was a minister, and Mary Stannard was a fallen woman. Shortly thereafter, one of his parishioners went to the police with a packet of arsenic, which he alleged he had found in Haydon's barn. It contained precisely 1 ounce. The police were puzzled, since they had already made a thorough search of the barn. But Haydon's trial was delayed for a year, while a Yale professor went to England to analyse samples of the arsenic found in the barn and in the stomach of Mary Stannard. Predictably, a jury found itself unable to agree on Haydon's guilt, and he was released. In 19th-century Connecticut, a respectable clergyman was presumed innocent, even when proved guilty. What's so interesting about this case is that it reveals so clearly the basic criminological pattern of the unwanted mistress murder. To begin with, the majority of men who kill unwanted mistresses are Don Juan types, dominant males with a powerful sex drive. Now, if a Don Juan is handsome and wealthy, he can take his pick of desirable women, particularly those who are pretty and wealthy. If he's neither handsome nor wealthy, he will take whatever he can get, and the girls he will find easiest to get are those whose dominance is altogether lower and whose inferior social position makes them more easily accessible. So the Reverend Haydon seduces a maidservant who has already had one illegitimate child. However, and here is the important point, having seduced this social reject, he feels no further interest in her. As Abraham Maslow's researches into dominance showed, men and women, given a free choice, tend to choose permanent partners within their own dominance group. And a high-dominance Don Juan soon begins to find a low-dominance female incredibly boring. And if she also threatens his social position, and therefore his craving for recognition and respect, he's likely to brood on ways of getting rid of her. These same basic features can be found in an English case of the Victorian age, the murder of Florence Dennis by James Canham Reed. Reed was a bookkeeper at the Royal Albert Docks in London, earning £3 a week. He was also married with 8 children. Now, this was a pity, for Reed had an insatiable sexual itch. He was a good-looking, well-dressed young man, and he devoted most of his spare time to the pursuit of love affairs. One of his mistresses was a married woman, a Mrs. Ayris, and they wrote to one another under assumed names, writing to a small stationer's shop, and Reed called on her when her husband was out. One day they met on a common. Mrs. Ayris had brought her sister with her, a pretty, dark-haired girl of 19 named Florence Dennis. As soon as Reed saw her, he felt the familiar itch. How he managed to continue seeing her without her sister's knowledge is a matter for conjecture, but soon Florence Dennis also became his mistress. Reed was leading an involved sex life at the time, for he was also having an affair with a third woman who knew him as Mr. Benson, a commercial traveller. He had installed her in a cottage at Mitcham. It was sometime in 1892 when Reed met Florence, and their affair continued for the next 2 years. And in June 1894, Florence discovered that she was pregnant. For a Victorian young lady, this was the end of the world. She wrote Reed a letter and addressed it to him under his own name at the Royal Albert Docks. It said, "Dear Sir, I have left Sheerness, her parents' home, and am staying at Southend. I should like to know what arrangements you have made." Reed realised that this was a determined young woman who might become very difficult. He stopped visiting the Mitcham mistress for several weeks and held clandestine meetings with Florence instead. And on a warm evening in late June, he and Florence walked in the fields near the village of Prittlewell, near Southend, where Mrs. Ayres lived. In his pocket, Reed was carrying a revolver. At some time between 9 and 10, he shot Florence Dennis in the forehead at close range and then pushed her body into a ditch and walked away quickly. An old lady saw him, and he asked her the way to Prittlewell. But he seems to have lost his way. After midnight, a man asked a policeman the way to London. The constable noticed his face and later identified him as Canham Reed. But how could Reed have expected to get away with the murder? The answer is that he believed he had covered up his tracks. He had sworn the girl to silence, although she had not kept her promise. He had made the appointment to meet her with an unsigned telegram dropped into a pillar box. He had no idea that Florence's sister and her parents knew that she was pregnant by him. On the Monday after the murder, he received a rude shock when a telegram arrived at his place of work asking about Florence and signed by Mrs. Ayres. He sent back a letter claiming that he had not seen the young person in 18 months, but he realised that his plan had misfired. The only thing was to flee. He helped himself to the money from the office safe and then fled to his mistress in Rose Cottage, Mitcham. The police had little difficulty in tracing him there, and he was arrested. The revolver with which he shot Florence Dennis was never found, but a number of people, including his daughter, his sister, and the mistress from Rose Cottage, all testified that he had possessed such a weapon. Before the sentence of death, Reed made a speech, insisting that it was Mrs. Ayres he had met secretly on the evening of the murder, and that she had wanted to borrow £50 to procure an abortion for Florence, who had got herself pregnant with a soldier from Hounslow. It was a feeble defence, and it didn't prevent the judge from passing the sentence. The murder case on which Theodore Dreiser based his monumental novel, An American Tragedy, has many similar features. Son of Salvation Army preachers who neglected him, Chester Gillette, obtained a job in the shirt factory of his uncle near Cortland, New York. He quickly seduced 18-year-old Grace Brown, who became pregnant. When, in desperation, Grace threatened to tell his uncle, Gillette invited her for a boat trip on Big Moose Lake in the Adirondacks. On July the 11th, 1906, they rowed out of sight of the other trippers, and Grace was never seen again alive. Her body floated to the surface 3 days later, the face badly bruised, and the coroner reported that she had been dead, from heavy blows to the head, before she fell into the lake. Gillette was executed at Oban on March the 30th, 1908. Since those far-off days, the pattern has changed considerably. While England and France continued to produce unwanted lovers' cases that might have taken place 50 years earlier, the Wigwam murder is an example, American cases have displayed strange and perverse variations. Joe Ball, a 40-year-old alligator breeder and the owner of the Sociable Inn near Elmendorf, Texas, was the Don Juan type, who liked to hire pretty waitresses. But his own solution to the problem of what to do with the girls when he grew tired of them was to feed them to his pet alligators. Their pool, surrounded by wire, was in his back garden, and nearby stood a foul-smelling barrel containing chunks of rotting meat. In mid-September 1938, Ball's last mistress, Hazel Brown, disappeared, and her mother telephoned the sheriff of Elmendorf to inquire about her daughter. Ball, a stocky, ugly man, told the police that she had left to work in Laredo or El Paso. The sheriff discovered that a large number of waitresses, 4 in the past 2 years, had apparently left town just as unobtrusively as Hazel Brown, often leaving behind their clothes. And Hazel Brown had opened a bank account only 2 days before disappearing, leaving the money untouched. It certainly looked like murder. Sheriff Clevenhagen reasoned that Ball's feeble-minded hired man, Willie Sneed, must be an accessory to the crimes. He and his deputy called on Ball and told him that Sneed had spilled. Ball agreed to go with them and opened the cash register. He took out a gun with which he shot himself through the head. Sneed confessed to helping Ball dispose of the bodies and revealed that 2 of them, including that of Hazel Brown, were buried on the riverbank. Sneed was eventually sentenced to 2 years in prison as an accessory The alligators, 5 of them, were sent to the San Antonio Zoo, but they died, perhaps unable to adjust to the change of diet. In 1965, America was electrified by a case that seemed to indicate new dimensions in juvenile delinquency. It was on November the 9th of that year that a 19-year-old youth named Richard Bruns contacted the police in Columbus, Ohio, and told them that he had information about several murders that had taken place in Tucson, Arizona. The motive for his decision to talk was fear for the life of his girlfriend, who was still in Tucson. The man he wanted to see behind bars was 23-year-old Charles Schmidt, known as Smitty. The police quickly realized that this was the break they had been needing for some time. In the past year, there had been 4 disappearances of young girls, with all the indications that these were not ordinary runaways. On May the 31st, 1964, the mother of 15-year-old Arlene Rowe returned home from night work to find that her daughter had gone out on a date and had not returned. She was never seen again. Mrs. Rowe mentioned that Arlene had been asked to join a teenage sex club not long before her disappearance, and had told her mother, "You've got to be in or you're a nobody." Oddly enough, the girl's father, living in another part of the country, had a dream in which his daughter was murdered and rang his ex-wife to tell her about it. In mid-August 1965, 2 daughters of a Tucson doctor vanished. They were Gretchen Fritz, a pretty if neurotic 17-year-old, and her 13-year-old sister, Wendy. An extensive police search for them met the same dead end as in the case of Arlene. They mixed a great deal with many teenagers. Tucson is a teenager's town, being close to the campus of the University of Arizona, but no one seemed willing to talk. A few weeks later, on September the 8th, Sandra Hayes, another 15-year-old, failed to return from school, and the police were unable to find any trace of her. Richard Brun's revelations led to the immediate arrest of Smitty, and to the discovery that many of Tucson's teenagers led sex lives that would have impressed Casanova. Charles Schmidt was 5 feet 3 inches tall and wore boots with high heels to increase his height. His well-to-do parents had given him a house of his own at the end of their garden, and he used it for orgies. In the subsequent investigation, it was revealed that Gretchen Fritz had been his mistress, but that she had become possessive. On August the 16th, 1965, Schmidt had invited her to his pad. She brought her younger sister with her, but it made no difference. Schmidt strangled them both and dumped their bodies in the desert. A year earlier, he had buried the body of Arlene Rowe nearby. He and 2 other teenagers, John Saunders and Mary French, had called for her late at night. They took her out to the desert, and she left the car with the 2 males, who apparently intended to initiate her into the sex club in the quickest way. When she screamed and struggled, she was battered to death with rocks. Schmidt then buried her with a shovel he kept in the boot of his car. The odd thing was that Schmidt made no effort to keep the murders secret. Many Tucson teenagers knew that he had killed Arlene Rowe, but they took care not to mention it to their parents. Schmidt actually showed Richard Bruns the bodies of the 2 Fritz girls in the desert, and Bruns later led the police to their skeletons. Arlene Rowe's body was not recovered. Neither could the police find any trace of Sandra Hayes. Schmidt was tried separately and sentenced to death, but appeals delayed the sentence until the death penalty was abolished. To murder an unwanted mistress or lover indicates an erosion of normal human feeling. But the strange, emotionless brutality of many recent cases, like that of Schmidt, suggests that our over-mechanized civilization is adding a new dimension of sickness to the age-old violence.